From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Caudette, and this is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it is time for our reporter roundtable. We will, of course, get you updated on all of the news that made headlines in our region this last week. Our panel today includes Dawn Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Kayla Brodell, KUNR's Mountain West News Bureau reporter, Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with Idaho Capital Sun, Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer, and Logan Finney, associate producer with Idaho Public Television. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hello.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Okay, Logan, I'd like to start with you, and I know you guys will be reporting on this tonight on Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, but can you explain to us what's going on in terms of Idaho's primary election and how it could potentially impact the 2024 presidential race?
Sure. Yeah. For a longtime listener, first time panelist, thanks for having me on.
Well, we're happy to have you here.
So this specifically has to do with Idaho's presidential primary, which is coming up in 2024. Lawmakers did a lot with elections this year, or a lot looking at elections anyway. And they moved to combine the presidential primary with the regular primary for every other statewide office, whether that's your county commissioners, your legislative districts, all those other primaries happen in May. And so this move was to move the presidential primary from March to May, combine all those together. But because of some unaddressed issues in the bill, it turns out we may not have a presidential primary next year.
Huh? How is that possible?
Primaries are interesting beasts in that in a normal election, if you get the most votes, you win, right? But a primary is for determining who a party's nominees are going to be. So who's the Republican nominee for president? Who's the Democratic nominee for president? And so there are extra steps as part of that process that you wouldn't see for like a county commissioner or a lawmaker, because it's the national political parties that determine who those nominees are. So if you think back to 2016, our presidential primary here, the Republican primary, Ted Cruz won Idaho during that process, but Donald Trump became the party's nominee. And so you have to have in state law that, you know, Idaho's not going to be the one state that has Ted Cruz instead of Donald Trump on the ballot. You have to go with who the party picks. And so a lot of those details weren't in the bill to move the date of the primary. And so the date has been moved, but there's no actual legal mechanism to actually say we're going to run it on this date.
Oh, interesting. And you spoke with Secretary of State Phil McGrane, correct? And what is he saying about this?
Correct. Yeah, he says that it's ultimately going to have to be decided by the political parties. So the Idaho State Republican Party and the Idaho State Democratic Party are going to have to meet with their national parties, meet with their members, and decide what to do here, because, you know, they could do something like hold a caucus. They could change their own party rules to determine how they're going to set up those presidential nominating delegates. And so when it comes to a presidential primary like this, it's just an option that the parties could use. The parties can go to the state and say, hey, we want to use your election infrastructure to pick who our nominee is going to be. And so since they don't have that option, the party membership are going to have to decide how do they want to handle their presidential contest coming up in 2024.
And so I would make the assumption then, Logan, if our legislators, you know, all of a sudden say, oh, what we actually meant was to be move all the laws so we can have this primary in May, they can't make those changes until they were to come back into session next year. But then even if they did change something, I would assume it would potentially not go into effect until like July 1 of 24, well past the date of the primary.
Yes, it would be really, really tough to get this back in place at the beginning of next legislative session. By the time we get to January 2024, the campaign's already going to be well underway and things are going to be, you know, running fast and furious at that point. Secretary McGrane, when I talked to him this morning, he did say that if the parties and the lawmakers and the executive branch, you know, if they came to some sort of consensus about what to do, they could maybe re-implement a primary at the very beginning of that session. But it would be really difficult, not just politically, but also for the county clerks who actually have to run the election system, put the ballots together. He said logistically, it would be a very heavy lift for them to take this up in the 24 session.
Okay, so the likelihood is we will not see a presidential primary next year.
Although I will throw out, Gemma, you know, there is the possibility of, you know, if something happened this summer and we figured out an answer, lawmakers do have the ability to call themselves into special session now under that constitutional amendment last year, or the governor could call them for a session. Of course, that would be reliant on them deciding what the next step is going to be. So really what's going to happen is we're going to wait and see what the Idaho Republican Party and what the Idaho Democratic Party want to do when it comes to the presidential race.
Okay. Don, two new members of the Boise City Council were recently appointed, but we now have a former city council member who is suing the city. So can you start by kind of giving us the backstory on why these two positions needed to be filled, and then what's going on as of today?
Yeah, it has been a busy week on the city of Boise.
Yeah. Oh, no. Did we lose Don? Did he? Okay. All right. We're going to hook Don back up because, you know, we just wanted to tease that until we got him. But no, we have a technical issue. So we're going to get Don hooked back up. So, Brian, let me bring you into the conversation.
I'm here now.
Because there is a controversial figure who will be in Eastern Idaho this weekend. It will be in support of the GOP party. I'm talking about Kyle Rittenhouse. Talk to us, though, about, A, why he's going to be there, but then, B, there are tickets being sold for a particular event.
Yeah, that's right. So Kyle Rittenhouse, who folks may remember, shot three men, killing two of them during a 2020 protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's going to be in Idaho Falls for the Bonneville County Republican Party's Lincoln Day fundraiser. This is their sort of biggest annual fundraiser, and they have a long history of bringing in sort of conspiracy theorists and right-wing provocateurs, people like Glenn Beck, James O'Keefe, Candace Owens, Dinesh D'Souza. But bringing in Rittenhouse is a little bit different because he's going to be a featured speaker like they were. But he's not somebody with this, depth of he's not the same sort of conservative media figure. He's most well known for shooting some protesters who were pursuing him. And after the morning following the fundraiser, there's also an event where he'll be at a shooting range, it's an indoor shooting range where they rent out automatic weapons for people to shoot, among other things. He'll be signing autographs there. He'll be shooting with folks, things like that.
And we should note, he'll be getting paid for all of this, correct?
Presumably. They're not required to release, the Republican Party is not a public entity, so they're not required to release any information about that. But typically on the Republican speaking circuit, you can expect several thousand dollars for an appearance like this. I'd be willing to bet that Rittenhouse is going to take a pretty big paycheck away from this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Don, we've got you back. Sorry for that technical issue. So let's get back to what's been going on with the Boise City Council.
Yep.
So start with why they did have to name two new council members.
Yeah. So the state house, the legislature left town, and Boise City Hall cranked up. A lot going on this beat. As you mentioned, when you queued me up the first time, there are two vacant city council seats right now. One belongs to former council member Elaine Clegg, who went to be the CEO of Valley Regional Transit. And the other formerly belonged to Lisa Sanchez, who served District 3. Our Margaret Carmel has been following this very closely, and it's a touch complicated. But what happened is the city has been under a multi-year process to move from elections at large, meaning the entire city voted for all six seats, to elections by district. This was mandated by the Idaho legislature. And it was a two-step process. Because they couldn't just throw the people out of their seats, they took three of the seats and put them in districts during the election 2 years ago. And then all six of the seats were going to be up again for re-election this fall. The city council and the city attorney said that Lisa Sanchez moved to a home that was out of the current district that she serves. It was within the new district that would be up for election this fall, but the maps aren't exact. There are some areas that are in different districts because they reapportioned the districts based upon the recent census. So the city said that Councilmember Sanchez, former Councilmember Sanchez, moved to a house that was in her upcoming district for an election this fall, but out of the district she was elected to. The council member had a meeting with the president of the council, Holly Woodings, and the president pro tem, Jimmy Halliburton, as well as the city attorney. And her attorney, Lisa's attorney, Councilmember Sanchez's attorney, earlier this year, where they basically said, it's our legal opinion that you are no longer qualified to serve in your seat because you moved. Former Councilmember Sanchez then moved back to another house that happened to be within both districts and applied to be appointed to her old seat by Boise Mayor Lauren McLean. The mayor had issued a news release that said, in essence, that she hoped to honor the will of the voters and potentially reappoint Lisa if she chose to submit for the seat. Councilmember Sanchez did choose to apply. The city said that it was going to name the replacements for the two seats, Elaine Clegg's seat and Lisa Sanchez's seat, by mid-March. That deadline came and went, and several weeks went by. The mayor ultimately declined to appoint Ms. Sanchez to her old seat, instead picking Latonia Haney-Keith for her seat and Colin Nash for Elaine Clegg's at-large seat. Ms. Sanchez and her attorney, Wendy Olson, had been threatening to sue the city. And did. They filed this week saying that that she was removed from her seat without any precedence and without any process, and asked that she be reinstated and that the council not make any further actions until that happened. The city declined to comment on this, as you can imagine, because of pending litigation. And we're going to see where this goes. You're going to probably want to really read the full story up that Margaret's written on BoiseDev.com to get all the nuance here. There's a lot going on here. We're going to continue to follow this in weeks to come.
Mm-hmm. And so, Don, to play the devil's advocate here, I mean, Lisa Sanchez moved out of her district, right? Goes into a different district. My understanding is she then tells the city council, you know, I moved. And I mean, per code, you have to live in the district that you represent. So she gives up her seat, but then moves back and then wants her seat back. And I've seen a lot of back and forth with this, read a lot of back and forth with this, where a lot of people say, first off, we elected her, so she should have been reappointed. But other folks are saying, well, she should have known better and not moved out of the district. And so it's on her. So, I mean, I know that's simplifying all of this, but is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that your assessment there is spot on. There are two different schools of thought. Look, part of this is politics. And I don't mean politics in maybe the way that we all think of as being very negative. The way the process to appoint somebody to a vacant seat for city council works is the elected mayor puts forth a name and the city council holds a vote. And Ian Stevenson over at the Idaho Statesman has done some really good work on this too. And the city council members indicated to Ian on the record that they couldn't vote for Councilmember Sanchez. This fact is actually referred to in the lawsuit. Former council member Elaine Clegg told Ian at the Statesman essentially that maybe a different tone might have been better. So if the mayor had, let's just say, nominated Lisa to her old seat. Her fate was ultimately in the hands of the remaining city council members on whether they wanted to approve her. And that's where it gets sticky. And there's been allegations made about a city staffer. There was in the lawsuit and in our prior reporting, there was an extensive back and forth about actions that the former council member took. There's this kind of interesting sequence in the lawsuit where it says that the council member had shown a city council staffer her address. And then it sort of says, but she moved to an address two blocks away. And we saw that. We're a little puzzled at just what that was trying to say, because it indicates that she showed city council staff an address, but then picked a different address that just wasn't in the district. She also says that she tried to clear this with Ada County Elections. It's a little inconclusive what happened there. We obtained some city council or some public records from the Ada County Elections Office where she did say, "Hey, I'm moving. I need to get this cleared." The clerk said, "Cool. Once you get in your new house, just send us your address and we'll change your voter ID." And the council member said, "I've secured new housing," and that was kind of the end of the paper trail. So there's no real evidence that she gave them a specific address. So, you know, it feels, I think, to people listening, like, gosh, this is a lot of minutia and a lot of, it seems like technicality. And you know, I think in some sense it is. This isn't the first time an elected official has moved out of their district, and it's caused issue in Idaho. It's happened other times. And so this is ultimately going to go before a judge, and the judge will have to decide what to do. But it's also really interesting to note that there's another council member in her seat now. LaTanya Haney-Keith is now serving the District 3 is what it's called. And I actually just checked to see if the city has put down its agenda for its meetings on Tuesday. It hasn't yet, but I would imagine that they will move forward with their regular meeting. And unless a judge files an injunction, they're going to continue business as usual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I must say, I mean, I'm sure that this is going to go before a judge. We're going to see this play out. I mean, you know, we could see the city council election come up before this even gets settled. Yeah.
That's one other thing that's really important to note here. So that's the seat is up this fall. Former council member Sanchez has indicated she will run. LaTanya Haney-Keith, my apologies, has indicated she will not run. But the interesting factor that's important here is that council pro tem Jimmy Halliburton is also going to run in that same district. Mm. And so there's definitely some, I hate to use the word intrigue, but there's some interest because for this election, you will see at least Lisa Sanchez and Jimmy Halliburton run. Lisa Sanchez once told me years ago that she helped recruit Councilmember Halliburton to the council. And so really fascinating political dynamics there that will play out over the rest of the year. And this, you're right, this court case may be moot by the time it's ruled on.
Yeah, I think it's going to be super interesting. So, Audrey, some more problems for a controversial physician, Dr. Ryan Cole. Can you start out, though, first, for folks who may not be familiar with Dr. Cole, who he is, why he's controversial, but then tell us what's happening now with a lawsuit.
Sure. So Dr. Ryan Cole is a physician who is on the Central District Health Board of Medicine. Or Board of Health, sorry, kind of steering the ship, so to speak, of the region's the largest regional public health agency in Idaho. He also is a frequent speaker on kind of a national speaker circuit at Times International regarding COVID-19 vaccines, and he did run Cole Diagnostics Laboratory in Garden City for a very, very long time. He was the medical director and the CEO, and he recently said in an interview that he has sold the laboratory and is no longer doing that work, but he is still doing some consultation. He is a dermatopathologist, so he specializes in skin diseases, but he's also board certified in anatomic and clinical pathology. So he has, out of Cole Diagnostics, for years been running doing certain blood tests, and he was also where his lab was one of the kind of go-to places for women's health practices. So earlier this week, a patient filed a lawsuit against him, saying that in July 2021, she had a biopsy done out of concerns about possible uterine cancer, endometrial cancer. And that biopsy was sent to his laboratory. He diagnosed it as, sure enough, endometrial cancer, a fairly aggressive kind, a fast-moving kind. And she ended up having a hysterectomy and removal of her fallopian tubes and ovaries and tissue surrounding, tissue and lymph nodes surrounding her uterus in her pelvic area. So it was a pretty invasive surgery. And the allegations in the lawsuit are negligence and some other harms. It is unclear right now what the possible damages would be if this case moves forward, because that would be determined at trial. But they have asked kind of a minimum of $25,000 for each of, I believe it's three different counts. But that's kind of a pro forma, like $25,000 or more in court. So we'll see what ends up happening with that. I contacted Dr. Cole and his attorneys and his wife, who's managed some of his marketing stuff in the past, yesterday, and I did not hear back from them. It should be said, though, that before you can proceed with a medical malpractice case in Idaho, you have to go through a pre-litigation screening process where a panel is convened and it's all confidential. They look at the evidence, they present it to the provider. In this case, it would be Dr. Cole. And so I don't know if he has seen the lawsuit yet, but he would know of the allegations in general. Kind of an interesting turn in reporting this story was I had reported last year on complaints to the Washington Medical Commission about a woman who had been diagnosed with uterine cancer, endometrial cancer, and went on to have a hysterectomy. And the same kind of surgery. But this person was about 15 years older, and the description, not at all able to, you know, identify someone, but it did not sound like the woman that I interviewed. It was a different patient. So so it was interesting when I found out about this lawsuit that this, you know, it's not the same person. It's another patient. So there are now two patients that have reportedly had a misdiagnosis of this kind of cancer and gone on to have major, major surgery as a result of it. So that was kind of an unexpected piece that happened during the reporting.
So at this point, Audrey, the lawsuit has been filed, correct?
Right.
And so we're just waiting then to see what happens next within that, within the suit then.
Right. So, doctor, you know, there could be, it could shake out many different ways. Dr. Cole could file a response to it. It could settle out of court. It could go to a jury trial. They have asked for a jury trial. A lot of times these cases don't end up in jury trials, but sometimes they do. I had reported on a case not so long ago, a medical malpractice case, totally different, but it ended up going to trial and got it. It was many millions of dollars in damages to the plaintiff. So I plan to follow this We're not just dropping it with the lawsuit. We will absolutely cover when Dr. Cole responds, if he does, to the lawsuit. Also the Washington Medical Commission's case. They brought charges against his license. And that is still working through the process. Cole has denied all of those charges and said that the commission is essentially stifling his First Amendment rights, and raises several other defenses as well. So we'll see how that plays out too.
Yeah. And folks, if you really want to go in depth with this, I mean, Audra did a great job of reiterating her story. But I think it goes even more in depth. So look that up on the Idaho Capital Sun and take a look at the article. With that said, Caleb, let's chat about quite the winter that many parts of the West Coast had. I know that even here in the Treasure Valley, we had snow yesterday on April 13th. But then you look at what happened in California with these atmospheric rivers. I mean, it has been kind of a mess of a winter. So the question is, where are we then in terms of the drought? I mean, are things better, the same? Well, do we know at this point?
We know some. Things are definitely better, just because, like you said, the amount of snow we've received in the West, just blanketed in snow. And folks at the U.S. Drought Portal say they're seeing over 100% or more of normal snowpack and precipitation levels pretty much across the West. So they called it, we're experiencing, quote, massive drought improvements. And since we're on Idaho Matters, I'll start with your state. In mid-March, nearly 73% of Idaho was experiencing drought conditions. Now it's down to 23%, which is obviously significant. And then in Nevada, during that same span, it's dropped from nearly 80% of the state in drought to 25%. And Utah, for example, is out of extreme drought levels for the first time in nearly 3 years. So there's good news, but the rub is it's kind of too soon to tell what that means for the West water supplies, right, according to the drought expert I spoke with. During these decades of drought we've been in, we rely heavily on groundwater, because our surface water, the reservoirs, the lakes, the streams are just too low to draw from. And she said groundwater is recharged through slow infiltration from gradual snow melt. So if the snow melts too quickly and we have flooding, it won't be recharged as effectively. So she said we're out of a meteorological drought, but whether we're still in a hydrological drought, that's a tongue twister, or an agricultural drought, is too early to tell. And here in greater Reno, Lake Tahoe, we're in a flood watch this weekend. So flooding is obviously something they're keeping their eyes on, and that'll dictate just how impressive these drought improvements are.
Okay. Really interesting to follow though. So thanks for that, Caleb. So Dawn, can we talk about this investigation into the Boise Police Department, because it's been put on hold? And why is that?
Ha, Gemma, it's another week where we're going to talk briefly about Brent Coles.
Oh my goodness, who knew?
So, you know, one of the things I wanted to do here is to check the invoices that Steptoe & Associates had submitted to the city of Boise for reimbursement for their investigation into practices of the Boise Police Department. And part of the reason for that is a few years ago, we had done some similar work when the city of Boise, under former Mayor Dave Beter, hired an architect to redo the library. And that architect and some of his associates flew to Boise first class. The reason that I bring up Brent Coles is because travel in the city of Boise is something we've long scrutinized in the aftermath of what happened 20 years ago. And I'm not going to recap that here. Google Brent Coles Boise and you can get some background. So we got,
it'll be a good read.
Yeah. It's definitely, we got these invoices because I wanted to just see how the dollars were being spent. All the travel seemed to check out, but what was interesting is we received the invoices for December, January, and February. We got these in mid-March, and it showed that they were just about out of money. So we checked with the city of Boise, and they said that they had exhausted the $500,000 that the council had allotted. And so we asked some questions. Are we going to get a final report? Are you going to continue? Are they going to, you know, continue the work? Where do we stand? And the city essentially said that they have to decide whether they're going to go back and ask the city council for additional funds to continue the work, and see what that would look like and how much. The $500,000 was exhausted in just about 3 months, so pretty quickly. We were able to look line by line at the invoices to see what had happened. And while a lot of personal details were left out, for instance, you know, individual officers who were spoken with, it didn't identify them. We were able to get a picture of some of the steps that they took. I will say I was struck that the investigatory team spent significant time looking at media stories, and a lot of the invoice hours are for that. So looking at the work done specifically, they called out KTVB, and they obtained an Idaho Statesman subscription. I would imagine they also looked at Boise Dev. I don't have any evidence to that, but that would be my guess, and other news outlets. They also reached out to former mayor Dave Beter to see if he would participate. I sent a question to the former mayor if he had agreed to participate. He didn't respond to that. We know that they had worked to interview Captain Tom Fleming, who used to head internal affairs, and former Office of Police Accountability Jesus Hara director, OPA director Jesus Hara. Those two men share an attorney, and they said they would only participate with the investigation in written form, no oral interviews. And something that also is interesting is, and I don't think that the Steptoe team meant to lead me here, or anybody here. I'm not sure they expected me to ask for invoices, and yet we did. But they spent about a full day in early January interviewing someone they just identified as BPD member. But when you cross-reference the request for reimbursement for some Uber rides, they said they took an Uber ride here in Boise to interview Ryan Lee on that same day. Ryan Lee, of course, is the former Boise police chief who oversaw the department before the mayor asked him to step down in September. So it looks like they've done a lot of initial work, but we really don't know how much more work they have to do, how much it's going to cost, what that might look like, how long it's going to take, when it's going to be in front of the city council. We have a lot of questions here. We're going to continue following this because, as we've noted, we are in a municipal election year, and this is something that will definitely be on the minds of some voters.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Brian, talk to us about an opinion piece your team wrote recently. This is in regards to Attorney General Raul Labrador, who's done some backpedaling. I wouldn't say it's an opinion that he wrote. That's not what he's calling it, but a letter, I guess, that he wrote in regards to whether a physician can refer a patient out of state to seek an abortion.
Right. So what Labrador wrote, or at least someone in his office that he then signed, was a legal analysis that was requested by Representative Brent Crane. This is something the Attorney General does quite normally, and it is something of a legal opinion. It's an opinion about how the law, you know, what the meaning of the law is. And what he concluded was that Idaho law prohibited any Idaho medical provider from either referring a woman across state lines for abortion services or to prescribe abortion pills that a woman could then pick up across state lines. And he, in fact, said that Idaho law would require the suspension of their license. Require, not optional. This was the opinion he issued on March 27th. He was promptly sued for that opinion by several doctors who said that they that this would endanger them, and almost immediately, less than 2 weeks after that opinion was issued, Labrador basically rescinded it and said that it was not guidance for law enforcement. It had just been an opinion for Representative Crane.
Mm-hmm. My understanding, though, too, Brian, isn't it at some point, didn't the attorney general say, look, I didn't write this, but yet his signature was on this opinion piece that was given to Crane.
Yeah, his signature was on the legal opinion. Whether or not somebody authored it, hard to say. But his signature was on it. And the thing about a legal opinion like this is it's not guidance about priorities for law enforcement. It's what it is an interpretation of what Idaho law means. That shouldn't change depending on who the audience is, because it's supposed to be objectively, here's what the law means, here's what it requires. And Labrador is the state's chief law enforcement officer. So it says something a little bit frightening that he's willing to issue an opinion like this and then reverse himself just on a dime as soon as he's sued in order to avoid getting slowed down by the courts, which seemed likely.
Well, you make an interesting point, I think, Brian, in this opinion piece that you wrote in regards to that, is that Attorney General Labrador has been in Congress. I mean, he's been in the midst of politics before, right? And I think that as you note in your article, you say, quote, when you fire off a shocking press release in Congress, you insert yourself into the cable news cycle. It's thoroughly unserious place, and that's politics, unquote. You go on to say the difference, though, is that, as you said, he is the primary law enforcement officer in the state of Idaho, with his client being the state of Idaho. And so is it that I think a lot of detractors would say, well, he does, he is this political animal, right? He knows what he's doing. On the flip side, I mean, it's one of these things where maybe there isn't as much experience in the fact of overseeing the entire state from a legal standpoint, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a difference between acting in a legislative body where more or less everything you do is covered by a part of the Constitution called the Speech and Debate Clause, which basically says the idea is to give Congress free rein to debate issues, to debate topics. And so it's very hard to hold them legally responsible for anything that they say, whether it's true or not, anything like that. It's a very different thing for an attorney general to issue a legal opinion. That's the government acting. Labrador has spent most of his time, much more time than he spent as a actively practicing lawyer in legislative bodies, in the Idaho legislature and in Congress. And so it doesn't seem like to me anyway that he has mastered this set of this sort of key difference between what it is to be a politician firing from the hip and it doesn't mean much in Congress versus being the state's chief law enforcement officer.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to you now, Caleb, because I want to talk a little bit about some federal funding that the Mountain West is getting. This is in regards to wildfires. Can you give us some details on this? Because, we have seen some intense wildfire seasons in the last handful of years.
Yeah, definitely. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture is spending nearly $200 million to reduce wildfire risk in at-risk communities. And like you mentioned, some of that money is going to projects in our region. Most of these projects are focused on things like clearing flammable brush near homes and businesses, mitigate hazardous fuels that pile up in forests, and also just kind of create wildfire awareness, education, and outreach programs. In our region, the largest shares are going to projects in New Mexico, which total about $11 million. Work in central Utah is getting nearly $5 million. Where I'm at around Reno, we're getting about $2 million. And then in Idaho, projects in Clark and Idaho counties total close to $1 million. And these are part of the first round of funding that is under this new community wildfire defense grant program, which is making up to $1 billion available over the next 5 years. So they're obviously making some really big investments in trying to limit the wildfire impacts that we face here.
Don, we're finally getting a look at what the new downtown Boise YMCA may look like. Tell us about this and where the project stands, because wow, that is quite a change from what we have right now. Oh, we lost Don again. Okay, well, guess what, Audrey, you're up next. And I do love this story, and I'm so excited that we get to talk about it. Can you talk to tell us about this new program for low-income moms? Because what a great benefit for these new parents.
Yeah. So, as I think any parent could say, when you have your first child, it's like, oh my gosh, you're leaving the hospital or the birthing center, and you're like, what am I going to do now? I wish I could take my nurse home with me. And that's actually what the nurse who is running this program for Central District Health said. She said, with this program, you can actually take your nurse home with you.
Wow.
It is called a nurse family partnership. These are essentially home visiting programs that have a nurse come to the home of the patient who is pregnant, one to two times, every 1 to 2 weeks, and they provide basically some prenatal screenings. They help answer all of the questions you can imagine. They get the person prepared for birth, prepared for being insured, prepared to feed the child, all those kinds of things. Central District Health didn't have this program until just this year. Southwest District Health has had it for a few years, and Panhandle Health District was the first to adopt it in Idaho. And it's a structure that's been used for decades around the country. So if anyone is interested in this, you must have an income level that would qualify you for Medicaid or WIC, Women, Infants, and Children's. You don't have to already be enrolled in those programs, though, but you do need to have a low enough income to qualify for it. You need to be a first-time parent, so not have any previous live births, and you have to be under 28 or 29 weeks gestation. And you need to live in an area where they offer these services. And the contact information is in the story, so please take advantage of it. Central District Health is now seeing people in Ada County, but they'll soon be opening it up to Elmore County as well. So they might be able to take some mountain home folks fairly soon. And the outcomes of this program are, like, the statistics are amazing. It basically... even for low risk, people who are at low risk of, you know, having poor outcomes, they still see an improvement, and it saves money. It's like $7 for every dollar invested, because the kids end up having better outcomes academically and socially. There are less complications for the pregnant patient, and the nurses continue to see these families for up to 2 years after the child's born.
I have to wrap you up. I think this is a great program. Read Audrey's article at the Idaho Capital Sun. Read Don's article about the YMCA downtown. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I've never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.